it's becoming less and less tied to the United States. It's just becoming a common form of communication between people, among people, in a very utilitarian way.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. My guest today, Rosemary Salamone, is the Kenneth Wang Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law and author of the book, The Rise of English, Global Politics and the Power of Language. The book takes readers around the world to show the political, social, and cultural implications of English having been firmly established as the lingua franca. We kick off our conversation with a discussion of how English became the dominant global language. We then discuss how reactions against the dominance of English are shaping domestic and international politics in interesting and sometimes unusual ways. Both this book and our conversation are just chock full of really interesting facts. I think you'll appreciate this conversation. I know I did. And of course, as always, please visit globaldispatches.org if you'd like to get in touch with me to recommend someone I should interview or a topic I should cover. I always love hearing from you. Thank you. Now, here is my conversation with Rosemary Salamone. Can you explain how English became the dominant global language? Is the explanation just as simple as the fact that the British Empire gave way to the American century?
I guess it is that simple when you think of it. You know, at one time, British imperialism and the British Empire covered an enormous section of the globe. And so English was carried on and through various mechanisms that the British used. When it entered those countries, English, although I think people misunderstand, English was largely taught to the elite. You know, there was this thin layer of the elite that was educated in these colonial countries. And so people are somewhat surprised that a large population of India, for example, does not speak English fluently. We assume that they do. But in any event, yeah, it really did start with the British Empire. And just as that empire was unraveling in the mid-20th century, the United States was rising as an economic and military superpower, and also as a cultural superpower. So we had Hollywood promoting the influence of English, and the soft power of American culture was permeating the globe. And so what you see now is that American English or North American English spoken by citizens or individuals in the United States and Canada is much more prevalent and even taught much more frequently in schools across the globe than British English is. American English has really washed over British English at this point. You know, for young people everywhere, they pepper their language with English, even if they don't speak it well at all. You know, speaking English is cool. Parents are just clamoring to have their children learn English.
I wanted to, on that point, ask you about really like a key contention of your book, that English is more than just a spoken language. But I'm going to quote you here, quote, "English is an economic skill and a form of cultural capital." Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, and those are two separate but related factors. So English has such value in the global economy. When you think of how many multinational companies there are that are seeking individuals with English skills, some with multinational, with multilingual skills as well. But English buys a lot on the global economy. And this is what makes English, aside from the cultural value of it and that soft power value, it really has an economic value for young people and for parents, knowing that it would give their children a leg up, ultimately in their careers and in their jobs. So there is a market value. Many advertisements in other countries in Europe from large companies very specifically are looking for individuals who do have some fluency in English. So, you know, there really is the market value of it. And then there's the cultural value to it, which is the other side that makes it very appealing. Anything culturally attached to the United States has become very appealing. Although I must say, some of that gloss has been dimmed somewhat by our own politics. And also, it seems to me that English is becoming a more quote-unquote neutral language.
What do you mean by that?
It's becoming less and less tied to the United States. It's just becoming a common form of communication between people, among people, in a very utilitarian way. What I find interesting, I don't know if you've watched the film Anatomy of a Fall, and there you have a couple who, she speaks German, the wife, he speaks French, but they use English as their neutral language. It really struck me when I saw it, because there, even within a marriage, English has become the common language between the two of them.
And English as a language, as you noted earlier, is becoming less associated with America as a culture. Like, it doesn't really carry that cultural baggage as much as it did, say, a generation ago.
Exactly. You know, I think American culture, you know, our arts, our music, our dance, or whatever, is still attractive to the globe. But I don't think English is so tied to those factors any longer. English is just, in a very pragmatic way, in a very economic way, has value.
So that actually brings me to my next set of questions, which is, where around the world English as a language has become like a major political fault line that exposes perhaps deeper fissures in society. Now, some of these places, I think, are fairly obvious, or at least more obvious than others. But one place that caught me by surprise that you've studied is the Netherlands and an ongoing debate over what language to use in higher education there. Now, I spent a lot of time in my early 20s in the Netherlands. And frankly, it's like impossible to learn Dutch, because every time you try to speak it, someone will speak back to you in English, in better English than I as an American would speak. It's just like a very sort of fluent society, I suppose. What is going on in the Netherlands right now that is causing such consternation?
Some of that is tied to nationalism. Some of it is tied to concerns over immigration. And where it's really filtering through, you see it most visibly, and I talk about it in the book, is through higher education and English taught programs and courses in Dutch higher education institutions. The Netherlands and the Nordic countries as well have been on the forefront on teaching young people in primary schools English. And so The Dutch speak English quite well, quite fluently, because they're learning it at a very early age. And so institutions in the Netherlands and in the Nordic countries, and it's spreading throughout the globe and through Western Europe, higher ed institutions see English and English taught programs as a means to raise revenue. They're bringing in more students, and as a means to raise their international rankings, which are very important to them. Part of it also is declining demographics, an aging population, low birth rate, and they really do need workers. So there's this tension between the need for labor, the institutions themselves wanting to internationalize, and yet this nationalist movement in the Netherlands that's resisting immigration and bringing foreigners into the country. And so what you see now is a move where the Netherlands had the most English taught programs of any country in Europe. You see now these proposals, which are very likely to come to be, and this debate going on, whereby there would be a cap on the number of English taught programs, because you could understand if you cap the number of English taught courses and programs, you're going to get fewer international students coming in because they don't speak Dutch. That was the draw. And requiring those who do come in to learn Dutch, because there is this concern that they're losing their national language. If in fact everybody is speaking English, everybody is being educated in English, they're losing Dutch as a language for knowledge production itself, which is a concern in other countries as well.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, for nationalist politicians like Geert Wilders, the far right Dutch politician who, right, you know, may or may not become prime minister, probably not
probably
at this point.
Not. Looks,
probably not at this point, but made a run for it. But, you know, that whole kind of nationalist sentiment is, you know, if we start requiring Dutch to be taught, like for master's degree programs, that means that no one else from around the world will be able to get into these programs, and it'll open up more spots for, you know, good Dutch to be able to advance. So I do see that logic.
Yeah, and there were some practical concerns as well. International students were coming into the Netherlands and there was insufficient housing. I mean, they just couldn't find housing when they arrived there. And there was a concern that some Dutch students were being closed out of certain courses because they were competing with all these international students. And some concern that they were not training students in certain areas like psychology, for example, that would really serve the public speaking Dutch. So, you know, aside from nationalism and that hostility toward immigration, there were concerns about access and the quality of education as well.
I wanted to turn now to India now, where Prime Minister Modi has sought to reinvigorate Hindi as a national language. But English also is playing a really important role in society. Can you just kind of explain the social and political debates around English in India today?
It goes beyond just education. So again, on the one hand, you have many Indian students who want their children to learn English for the value on the global economy, and that's understandable. But just the politics and the history of India itself, you have all these regional languages. India is highly multilingual. And you have states, for example, states in the south, like the Tamils, who just rail against the idea of having to speak Hindi or teaching their children in Hindi. And so they have seen English as a bulwark against Hindi. And now you have this movement that is really promoted by Narendra Modi's government to Hinduize the country. And you're seeing extraordinary pushback from some regional segments within the country. But that has a lot to do with history and their sentiments toward Hindi, and not solely their interest in learning English.
I mean, that's interesting. So English, ostensibly the language of like the colonizers, is now seen as like a more egalitarian option for India.
It is, which is really quite interesting.
So broadly, globally, I know you have studied the geopolitics of language. What are some of like the key geopolitical trends you're seeing today regarding English as a language and English, as you say, as like a vector of economic attainment?
When I revisited the book was published in the US in the end of 2021. And then I revisited it for the paperback edition, which just came out in the US in January and will come out in the UK in May. I looked back over those 2 years to see, well, what had happened in those intervening years. And it was clear that English was still on the move, but there were still the same tensions that I saw initially, still the same tension within the European Union, within those institutions, as to whether English should be used, particularly after Brexit.
It's odd that the United Kingdom has left the EU, but English is still the dominant language of the EU.
Exactly. You know, the only two countries that are now still member states where English is one of the official languages are Ireland and Malta, and they're very small countries. And so there is this tension within these EU institutions, and yet English, for very practical and reasonable reasons, has now become the lingua franca, the common language, even though officially it's only one of the languages that are supposed to be used, and everything has to be translated into all the languages of all the member states. Still, in the very everyday workings, particularly of the Commission and of the Council, English is being used. France has resisted this. You know, when France became the head of the Council several years ago, Emmanuel Macron was certain that French would only be spoken during France's tenure there, and that was the rule. But English is not going to be replaced by French or any other language within the EU. So, you know, what I saw is the same tensions within the EU institutions, the same kind of tensions within higher education and these English taught programs. But I saw a shift, particularly, as we said, in the Netherlands and in the Nordic countries, toward a kind of a backlash that was fomenting against English. You know, these were the countries that were in the vanguard. They were the promoters of English from early on as compared to other countries. But within some of those countries, within Finland and Norway and Denmark and the Netherlands, you started to see this backlash. Whereas in countries like France and Italy that were rather slow in adopting English, you saw English chugging along and within higher education institutions. And you know, there was still the same kind of tension in India, but Hindi was moving forward within those 2 years. In South Africa, there was still a debate over English versus Afrikaans that has not been resolved. And those are all the reasons why I chose those particular countries to look at, because there was something rather interesting geopolitically within each of them. Within India, it was the caste system, and it was that tension with Hindi. Within South Africa, it was apartheid and what the Afrikaans language represented to Black South Africans, that this was the language of the oppressor. Even though it's not just white Afrikaners who speak Afrikaans, you have a large colored population that speaks Afrikaans as well. Within Morocco and Rwanda, these were former French speaking. Rwanda was not a French colony. It was a German, then a Belgian colony. But they had each had a certain history surrounding it. In Morocco, you also had Arabic coming into that whole debate. So, you know, each of these sites, I selected them for their particular geopolitical interest. And I saw within those 2 years that those same historical and political factors were still shaping language policies.
So I know your latest research focuses on geopolitics and language competition in Africa. And presumably this also has something to do with Chinese interests in Africa. What are some of the key trends you're seeing around that issue in Africa today?
The book that I'm now working on is kind of an extension of one of the chapters in The Rise of English, the chapter on the New Scramble for Africa. And there I looked at China and France in competition with each other. This is bigger, but it's really looking at language as soft power in Africa and how it was used historically by colonial powers, particularly France and Great Britain, but largely how it's being used today by China and Russia. And the Russian piece is the one that surprised me the most, as the more I've gotten into the research. But you see large disinformation campaigns being carried on by both China and Russia in Africa. Why is Africa so interesting to them? Well, you know, it's very rich in minerals. We know that. That's why many countries are interested in Africa. But Africa also has what we call this demographic dividend. You have a very large young population that's growing exponentially. And so world powers see that. And both China and Russia are using their languages to capture and engage that population.
Well, what would be a good example of like Russia doing that today? Because that seems just odd to me. I know there's like interests in certain Sahelian countries, but how is Russia using its language to advance its interests?
It did surprise me, Mark, when I saw, you know, I as I said, the rise of English looks at the Confucius Institutes in Africa, and that's kind of the playbook that China has used of joining universities, a university in Africa with a university in China in a partnership and providing language instruction within the African university. But these Confucius Institutes are around the world. They're much more controversial in the United States than elsewhere. So China has done that through the Confucius Institutes. Now Russia is following the China playbook. And so they're instituting language programs with universities, partnering universities from Russia and from Africa, particularly where the French have been thrown out, particularly in the former Francophone countries, where you've had several of them have undergone repeated coups and more recent coups. And so the Russians are moving in, and they're moving in using the power of the Russian language.
So looking ahead, and I suppose by ahead, I mean generations from now or a generation from now, because these language debates really are generational ones. What languages do you learn as children or young adults? What do you see as like the next iteration of the evolution of English as perhaps a lingua franca or other languages challenging English for that dominant spot?
I think for a long time, we're going to see English as the lingua franca. So much has been built on it. You know, now you cannot publish in the sciences unless you publish in English. So much knowledge now has been produced in English that that's going to carry weight for a number of years. And English, and so many people across the globe have invested in speaking English as this common language. So it's going to be the lingua franca for a long time. Maybe it's not going to be the requirements of standard English as we know it are not going to be as rigid. You know, that has become a serious problem for academics who are not Anglophones, you know, trying to write in standard English and have their work published or giving presentations at conferences in standard English. So it could be that some more form of world English will be developed, but more variations of it. Whether another language will ever replace it, if I had to guess, it would be Spanish, because Spanish is spoken by large segments of the population across the globe. So that would be, I think, my guess, but that wouldn't be for a long time. And, you know, and as much as Chinese and Russian are moving into Africa, I don't think either language is going to become a lingua franca. So, you know, if I had to sum it up, English is here to stay for quite some time. In what form, or whether it would be so rigidified, that's another question. And if I had to guess a substitute, it would be Spanish.
Rosemary, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me, Mark.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.